Good morning again to you all. And thank you. It's good to be with you and to see you. I want to talk a little bit about hope and what hope means for us as it relates to our preparation during the season of Advent and as we move toward Christmas, but also really just as we prepare, as Christians, I think, are always preparing for the world to one day be a little bit different than the world that we are currently inhabiting. So I want to talk about that at a couple of different levels. But for starters, I want to acknowledge that the word hope is one of those words that's really easy for us to say and that we say a lot, but that we do not necessarily all understand. And that even if we think we understand it, there are these layers to it that are more challenging. Hope, at its most basic level, many of you have heard me say before, is this persistent belief that there is a future that is better than the present, and that we have it either within our capabilities or somebody else who has power around us, or maybe even God, has the power to help make that future a reality. And so we have hope. It's just at a basic level what it is. And doesn't that just kind of take all the glory out of it, right? That takes all the energy out of that word hope. It's not glamorous anymore. It's just this persistent belief we have that maybe one day things will be a little bit better. Deep down in that sense of discomfort with that definition is our sense of how it's different for us than that. And that's fair. Christians hope a little bit differently than other people hope. I want to drive that point home for a minute to talk about hope in the ancient world in particular. I'm going to need some help probably from some of our younger folks. Here is the question for you. Do you remember the story of Pandora's box? Adults, I know, it's okay. And no, we're not talking about jewelry, so stop. Pandora's box. Young people, what was in Pandora's box? Okay. Maybe they don't do it quite as much. Do you? Yes, please. All the bad stuff. Like all the evil stuff you named, like all the sicknesses and diseases and all that sort of stuff. Okay. So I'm going to jog everybody else's memory because you know they don't know. I'm going to try to help them out a little bit. Zeus gives this gift. For starters, Zeus always gives bad gifts, so you should know what's going to happen here. Pandora carries the gift. It's a box. It's kind of like the fruit in the middle of the garden that Adam and Eve are not supposed to eat. Do not open the box, but like anybody with the big red button in front of her, Pandora's going to open the box. She opens the box. All of the evil and bad things come out of the box. Well done. And then she slaps the top of the box closed. And one thing remains inside the box. What is that? Do you remember? What is it? Hope. Well done. Thank you. Hope is the only thing left in the box. Now, we normally read that as a good thing because we are trained to think of hope as a good thing. But did you know that in the ancient world, many philosophers who wrote about that story actually thought that that was a bad thing? That hope was left inside the box to entice humans, to distract ourselves? That the real naive ones of us, in the middle of the world that is filled with all the bad things and the evil, would just keep staring at this box knowing that we could cling on to hope even while the world was falling down around us. And they thought, many of them thought anyway, that was a sign of weakness. Some really thought that we ought to ignore the box altogether and really pay more attention to the pains in the world and just embrace the fact that sometimes the world was going to be difficult. And again, that wasn't true for all Greek philosophers, because if you know anything about Greek philosophy, you know that they just spent basically an eternity arguing with each other. So there are others who took the other side of that argument, for sure, but many, maybe even most, saw hope as being something of a negative. Christians, as we began to interact with that Greek world and the words that came out of it, we rejected that notion immediately that hope was some sort of negative. We knew that there was a hope for a world that did not contain all of this evil. And in fact, we had hope for a future in which Jesus would return and heal all the broken things in this world. Those broken things that we cause and those broken things that are just part of our existence, and that God had the power to make that so. But there's one real distinct difference, and that is that in order to keep that hope from being just a distraction, to keep us from despairing, something we just stared at from time to time, we knew that hope was to be an active verb, not really just a belief that we held on to, but instead it would change the way that we would behave. So we actually embraced what Aristotle said, the one philosopher that I will go to in the Greek world who really, I think, was holding on to something that Christianity would name. A paraphrase of it is this: all hopeful people are not necessarily courageous, but all courageous people are necessarily hopeful. If you're going to have courage in this world, as it exists now, you better believe in a future that's brighter than today, and you better be willing to embrace that hope, to generate that courage, to behave differently today. A profile in that kind of courage might have been John the Baptist, who was weird, we have to say at the outset. Strange man, Jesus' cousin maybe, out in the wilderness, proclaiming that the kingdom was near and that people could come out through the desert from Jerusalem, miles and miles and miles down to the Jordan near the Dead Sea, and that they could there confess their sins. Who would go to the desert to confess their sins to some strange man wearing camel's hair and eating locusts? Takes a radical kind of courage just to do that. We'll start there. But they went, and he went, and they did these things that somehow stood in defiance of religion as they knew it. They knew that they were going to be going toe-to-toe with an empire that didn't want strong religion to begin with. It took a special amount of courage. And I should say that one of the things that John the Baptist says is that the kingdom is drawing near, even though there was so much evidence to the contrary around them. Life was hard, and they were under Roman imperial persecution and oppression. But that wasn't new to them. That had been going on for quite some time. Not always the Romans, sometimes it was others. The prophets before him, John the Baptist being a prophet probably himself, we might call him that. They knew what it was to have the courage to be in a world that was challenging and to proclaim a future that would be different. And they did it all the time, sometimes in strange ways. Jeremiah is my favorite. I think I've probably told some of y'all before about my favorite story of Jeremiah. When life was at its hardest and everything had kind of been destroyed, imagine this church no longer here and Ponte Vedra Beach and Jacks Beach and Jacksonville, all of it gone. And Jeremiah did the equivalent of going down the street and buying a corner lot and building a house there. Nobody lived there anymore. It was all destroyed. Nobody was ever going to return, he thought, or they thought. And he said, no. One day people will build houses. This neighborhood's coming back. Neighbor's going to build a vineyard. We're going to have some nice wine one day. It's going to be fantastic. It wasn't going to happen in his lifetime, and I think he knew that. I think everybody knew that. But he was demonstrating a future, demonstrating his hope, demonstrating his courage to be different in that world. Isaiah was like that as well. We heard Isaiah as our first reading today, screaming out, "Comfort my people. Your penalty's over. You've done all the hard stuff. Life is about to be good. God, the tender shepherd's going to come and take care of you." And he says that right in the middle of what is potentially up there as one of the worst disasters the Jewish people has ever faced. The temple is gone. The neighborhood is gone. And he says, "It's over. It's okay. It's all going to be fine." He had the courage to be different in a hope that wasn't about distracting himself from the present reality. It was about proclaiming the new reality in a way that allowed him to practice hope and courage in the present. The practice of hope, I think, is what sets us aside as Christians from those who would hope merely for the sake of a distraction. The practice of hope, I think, is one of our most important spiritual practices alongside the practice of faith and the practice of love. Paul writes about that. I'm not making that one up. We've got to practice hope. It's not something to give your intellectual assent to just believe in. It's something to put into practice. If you're like me, this has been a time, these last 9 months or so, in which hope has been something to hold on to for dear life and to put into practice when we can. I was talking with Casey, my wife, last night a little bit about our hopes for the next year. There's been so much good news about the potential for vaccines, the potential for goodwill to allow us to move past this moment. And so we started this list that you've probably done as well. What will we do? What will be different when we can finally just kind of go back to normal? What are the first things you're going to do? Oh, we have our list. Whew, do we have a list? The list, of course, will mirror almost perfectly the list of things you're probably missing. Really miss going to see live music at concerts and shows. I really miss musical theater. I would have never thought that that would have been something I would have said, but I really miss musical theater. I miss hugs, which is strange because I don't like hugs. I don't like touching, just generally speaking. But as soon as this thing is over, I'm hugging y'all, and you better watch it. Unless you don't want to, and then just tell me, and I won't. I miss that. My son will be a year old, and the last time my parents got to see him was right after he was born. I long for that. The list of things that I'm hopeful for and the list of things that I'm missing right now are the same list, but to be hopeful for those things changes who I am right now. Not only in terms of how I appreciate physical contact and hugs and appreciate music and those who make it, or theater and those who make it, but also changes the way that I'm preparing for that future. We are literally going to save more money so that we can watch every show and concert next year. So we better start saving now. And while that's a silly example, you get how it works. If the future is to be a future that looks like this and we want to put it into practice now, we better start practicing it now. Change the way we behave now. So what do you hope for? What do you long for? What is it that you hope will change in a world that expresses our deepest hopes for faith and love? So you approach Christmas for peace and for joy. While our short-term thoughts about what we hope for in a world that no longer is faced with a pandemic, while those are important, as Christians, we have always asked ourselves the question, if peace and joy and the healing of a broken world by the coming of Christ, if those are the things that we hope for, how will we practice our hope now? That is this season for us. That is our Advent meditation. As we prepare for Christmas, we prepare to answer that question. And I'll remind you that when we come to those answers as a Christian people, we embrace the courage to be and to act according to those answers. So give thought to what you hope for. Give thought to how you might practice that hope. And may God grant us all the courage to embrace both. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.